it said. "See." Somehow she managed to pry her stare away from the creatures ahead of them, noticing something beyond. A pinprick of colour she might not have noticed if she hadn't managed to focus her vision forward past the immediate threat. A small triangle of light amidst the dark stone walls of the tunnel. Straight ahead. An end and a beginning. "There!" she cried. "Our escape is there! We fight forward!"
35. The Hinterlands. Lisbeth Lorne. After Crone had assured her that Xur was not dead and only sleeping, his breath as soft as a whisper on his lips, Lisbeth returned to their dwelling. Exhaustion took her immediately, a monster of the deep pulling her down into the depths. She slept a dreamless sleep, the first of her short life as a human. A few hours later she awoke with a start, her pulse pounding between her temples.
"No, it's something else," she realized.
There it was again, a dull thumping, reverberating through the night. Thump, thump. Other sounds accompanied it, snarled shouts, stamping feet, mournful howls.
"What is happening?" she said,
more to herself than to anyone else. Still, Crone heard her, sticking her long head inside the ice dwelling.
"A call to arms. Ghazi ride to war."
"War? Why? Who?"
"This thing I do not know."
Lisbeth remembered the revelation she'd received earlier that night, what felt like an instant ago, a half an instant. A crucial part of her returned after having been missing for eons.
"My purpose for coming to this place, my purpose for having this body, in this place, in this time. War."
The word no longer felt like a declaration of doom, but an opportunity for change. She was not a destroyer herself, though she knew she was capable of great destruction, but a forger, a strengthener, a harbinger of great violence, of the war that was destined to come. Thumb, thumb. The drumbeat reminded her that such a fate was perhaps not a distant twinkling light like she'd hoped, but an approaching dawn brighter and colder than any before it.
"Is it here already?" she wondered. "Have I caused this?"
Then she thought of those powerful souls frozen in the Hall of War, of the pent-up violence she felt in her bones as she spoke to them, the centuries of stored purpose and aggression. If they were the lock, then she was the key. And if she opened this door,
I can never close it.
Somehow she knew this, the same way she knew her name, her purpose, like the knowledge was a part of her, had always been a part of her. Even as she slid through the fabric of time and space, a silvery ribbon of light.
"I have to go," Lisbeth said.
Thumb, thumb. Crone said nothing, stepping aside, letting her pass. Lisbeth drifted, more than walked, into the night, like a feather blown on a breeze, her feet barely seeming to brush the snow-crusted ground. The Ghazi were gathering in droves, spears bristling from their backs like a porcupine's quills. Some held spiked clubs over their heads menacingly, as if they were tempted to hit each other, too impatient to wait for whatever foe threatened them. Their wolfish steeds prowled around, their rough fur bristling, their mouths forming eternal snarls. Lisbeth scanned the mob for Xur, but he was noticeably absent. Instead, another stood at their head, a powerful being that rose a head taller than any others, his shoulders broad, the skin of his triangular face as rough as sun-dried leather.
"Warriors!" he shouted, raising a spear in the air. "At long last, the pact has been broken again. Filth invaders have come to our lands, seeking to sneak past our defences."
He spoke in Ghazi, but Lisbeth understood every word.
"It started with her, the spy."
All heads turned toward Lisbeth, as the great warrior pointed in her direction. She could see the hostility in their eyes, but also the fear. None would touch her. Not after what she'd done to Xur, to the legions that had been unable to kill her on the snowy hills.
"We cannot kill the blind witch, but we will string up those who follow her."
A roar of approval.
Tonight we will feast upon their flesh and remind all others that the pact is as strong as ever.
More cries, and the drums started up again, louder and faster than before. The warriors mounted up, digging their heels into the beasts, though it wasn't necessary. The creatures snarled, charging away, past the dwellings, past the hall of war, toward the frozen cliffs that cast a long shadow over the village. Lisbeth watched them go, uncertain, but then gave chase, running on her toes, feeling a rush of energy, of purpose.
Yes, I am meant to do this thing, whatever this thing is.
Atop their steeds, the warriors reached the base of the cliffs well ahead of her, immediately charging through a gap that led to a switchback trail, narrow and treacherous. The animals, however, were as sure-footed as goats, clambering up the path, snow blasting over the edge as they rounded the first bend. A few moments later, Lisbeth reached the trail, but didn't take it. No, it would be too slow, and she would be too late. Though she'd only spent days with these people, she knew what they were capable of, the violence they wore like a badge of honor. Instead, she ascended the cliffs. She didn't fly, nor climb, not exactly, but something else. She just moved up the sheer rock face because she wanted to, her fingertips and toes occasionally brushing the ice. Despite her more direct path, she continued to fall behind. The beasts and their riders knew these cliffs well, making short work of them.
"Hurry, hurry, hurry!"
Lisbeth urged herself as she climbed higher and higher, but a strange force seemed to push against her, thwarting her momentum, holding her back.
"I will be too late," she thought.
From high above, someone spoke, and though she couldn't make out the words, she could tell it wasn't spoken in Ghazi. No, this was spoken in the common tongue. Anise Gehrig.
"There are too many,"
Anise thought, swinging her Evenstar around and around, feeling the satisfying but somewhat sickening smack of metal on soft flesh. Their enemies' glowing white blood was everywhere, the ground, the walls, on their clothes and skin. But still they came, emerging from the side tunnels like water pouring from pipes, an endless supply that made every inch forward as difficult as wading through quicksand. Jonius at the front had taken several wounds, a claw across his cheek, a bite to the hand, a mangled ear, but had killed many, his sword moving from opponent to opponent in that graceful way of his that reminded Anise of a dance. Archer, considering his lack of true battle experience, had done remarkably well thus far, killing several of the cave dwellers and only suffering a bloodied nose. Dietrich, protecting their rear, had killed dozens of the creatures already, and more fell moment by moment on his sword, which spun, slashed, and stabbed like tornadoes and lightning, a storm of his own making. The bodies were piling up, just like in the images they'd seen painted on the walls, but that didn't mean they would emerge victorious, not when their foes seemed as innumerable as grains of sand on the edges of the ocean. Still, the light, the hope, Anise had spotted in the distance, continued to grow closer, larger. Step by hard-fought step, they made progress toward the escape that moments earlier had seemed improbable, if not impossible. As Anise passed the dark maw of yet another side tunnel, a blob of pale flesh flung itself at her. Instinctively, she shoved her torch in its direction. They'd quickly learned the creatures feared and despised fire, something they'd used to their advantage. Hissing, the creature twisted in mid-air to avoid being burned, which was exactly what Anise had been expecting. Crunch! Her Evenstar connected solidly with its face, ripping through its blind eyes and sinking deep into its skull. The creature dropped at her feet with a squishing sound, pulsing white blood pumping from the mortal wound she'd inflicted. Anise didn't have time to contemplate what it meant to kill a living creature, nor her feelings on the subject, for another was already clambering across the ceiling to attack from above. No, there was no time to think or consider or fathom the fathomless. There was only time to act, to do, to survive. The creature dropped so quickly it took her breath away. Her weapon was still ensconced in her previous foe's skull, and she was too slow by half in bringing her torch up. She only had one option, and she took it, pushing off from the balls of her feet, leaping upwards to meet the attack head-on. Literally. As she headbutted it in the jaw, she felt its fangs sink into her flesh, its claws rake across her cheeks. Pain flared through her skin like a series of hot pokers thrust under her flesh, but she managed to lurch forward and land atop it, shoving her torch in its face. The howl was so close to her ears she could hear nothing else for several moments, even as she watched it writhe and twist, its face burned black and bubbling, until it went still. She whirled around, seeking her next foe, but then realized how close they were to the light. In fact, Sejonius was already out of the cave, his body drenched in moonlight that seemed, after so long in the dark, as bright as a noonday sun. Archer was a mere step behind him, turning back to beckon to Anise and Dietrich, his mouth forming a soundless cry, "Hurry!" Behind Anise, Dietrich stood completely still, holding his torch aloft, peering into the gloom. The still, silent gloom.
"Sir?"
Anise said, dumbfounded. Where was the enemy? Just a moment ago she'd sworn the creatures were everywhere, on all sides. But now? "Something scared them off," Dietrich said. Instead of sounding victorious, he sounded worried.
"That's a good thing, right?"
"Depends on what scared them off," he said, turning and ushering her toward the exit, where the others were waiting. When Anise stepped into the moonlight, she was forced to shield her eyes against the bright green and red orbs shining from opposite sides of the sky, their long beams of light criss-crossing on the cliffs. This far north, the moons seemed closer somehow, bigger, brighter. In this midst of certain death, Anise had assumed she'd never see them again, and now she relished the way the light washed over her like a winter storm. Archer seemed to be doing the same, holding his blood-soaked arms to either side as a light breeze blew across the cliffs. Jonius was already moving down a narrow path that led away from the tunnel, scouting the terrain for weaknesses where the ice and snow might fall away. Dietrich, however, had slid onto his belly, peering over the edge. "Damn," was all he said. That's when Anise heard the drums. Taryn Sheery. Any possibility of sleep was vanquished the moment he felt the danger. Not to him, but to her, channeled through him by whatever dark magic the monster had conjured. Taryn sat up sharply in bed, all weariness chased away in an instant, his muscles flexing, his body urging him to find her.
"She is out of reach,"
the monster hissed. It was a truth he already knew, but still, it was like a bucket of cold water had been thrown over his head. Taryn had never felt so helpless in his life, save perhaps for when he'd contracted the bone disease that had eventually led him to this very place.
"Everything comes full circle," he thought,
even as he concentrated on that feeling inside him, that connection to Anise. He could feel her action, her fear, her desperation. Something was trying to hurt her, maybe even kill her, but she wasn't dead yet. For a long time, Taryn just sat there, ragged breaths pushing between his clenched teeth, blood pumping through his veins, his heart pounding as if he was the one in grave peril. And then, abruptly, the feeling passed, leaving him exhausted and breathless, though he'd barely moved. At first he thought,
"No, no, no, no!"
because the emptiness he felt could only mean one thing.
"She lives,"
the monster purred. Upon hearing those two words, he collapsed on the ground, the sense of relief as powerful an emotion as he'd ever felt before. But then, like a hot knife shoved into his heart, the rush of danger, of fear, returned in an instant. Anise was under attack once more. Lisbeth Lorne. Lisbeth crested the cliff, which was packed full of Ghazi nestled shoulder to shoulder, spears shoved forward. Their tall spokesperson was barking in their rough language, spitting the words like darts through a blowgun.
"You have broken the pact. There is only one sentence. Death."
The chant went up through the crowd.
"Death! Death! Death!"
Somewhere beyond the warriors, a voice spoke in the common tongue, calm and placating.
"We don't understand what you're saying. We come to your lands in peace."
The Ghazi reverted to the common tongue.
"Filth language. I make understand. Pact broken. Now die.
No!
Lisbeth shouted in Ghazi. Several heads turned, but not all. Instead of shoving through the crowd, she spoke to those in her direct path where only they could hear her. Their souls were like soft clay to the invisible hands she moulded them with. The precision of her power was improving. Rather than collapsing, they simply moved aside, pressing closer against their brethren. A path was opened, and through it Lisbeth saw the exhausted, bedraggled souls of four strangers, three men and a woman. Lisbeth moved through the Ghazi toward them, her eyes cast forward. The tall Ghazi leader stepped across her path, for she had not yet touched his soul. If he was surprised at her sudden appearance, his soul, a roiling mixture of black and grey, almost like smoke, didn't show it. He spoke to her in the common language.
"Leave us. This is not your concern."
"My concern is my own," she said.
"Leave us,"
the Ghazi repeated.
"The pact broken. Punishment, death."
At that, dozens of warriors pointed their spears at the strangers once more. One of the humans, a tall man wearing dented armor, his face scarred, said, "Let's dance."
"No,"
Lisbeth said again, louder.
"There shall be no violence on this night."
In reply, the warriors screamed,
"Death!"
and attacked. Anis Gerick. Anis's head was still spinning from the turn of events. Evidently they'd stumbled from the fire and into the more of an even greater danger. After she'd heard the beat of their drums, the strange-looking warriors had rushed up the incline toward them. Jonas had danced back, Dietrich had found his feet, and the four of them had knotted together weapons at the ready. As the enemy had approached, Anis had taken in their unusual appearance. They were hairy, their exposed arms hidden beneath dark, bristly fur. Over their broad chests, they wore spiked bone armor, long, wispy hair falling from their scalps to their shoulders. Their faces were bone-hard and shaped like upside-down triangles, wide at the top and narrow and pointy at the bottom. Their eyes were too far apart, dark and intense, boring into them. More fearsome than any of that, however, were the steeds they rode, wolf-like in appearance, but much larger, with all-white coats and long snouts gaped open in snarls of fangs and dark gums. And then, in stark contrast to the enormous spear-wielding warriors and their beasts, a wisp of a girl had approached like a light in the dark, the sea of death parting for her like flaps of skin split by a sharp knife. A blue eye glowed on her forehead. A third eye, not real, but a marking. A skin mark, Anis immediately recognized. The girl had seemed to argue with one of the warriors, the tallest of the bunch, but whatever she'd said had made no difference. Now the spears closed in, jabbing toward them from all sides, cutting off any hope of escape, herding them toward the edge of the cliff. Dietrich lashed out with his sword, severing several of the sharp tips. More spear points immediately took their place. Anis shifted back, trying to gain some breathing room. The others retreated as well, though there was nowhere to go but off the cliff or back into the tunnels. Both options felt like certain death. Anis clutched Archer on one side and Jonas on the other. As they stumbled back, the spears followed. Anis glanced behind, dizziness swarming as she took in the sheer drop they faced. She tripped as the ice cracked along the edge. Archer grasped her arm, pulling her back from the brink. He nodded, and his expression seemed stripped down, all arrogance and bravado gone. It was the most real look he'd ever given her. In this moment, he was simply her brother. Her kin. They'd survived much together, and it felt right that the end would come by his side. As if to echo her thoughts, the tall warrior spoke.
"Now you die," he said, meeting her eyes with his, which seemed to burn with dark fire.
"Goodbye, Terin,"
Anis thought, hoping the monster was still there to hear, that it would pass her final words to the only man she'd ever truly loved.
"I will always love you."
36. The Northern Kingdom, Darin. Terin Shiri. Her words tore through him like a thousand knives.
Terin could hear her voice, its richness, its truth, a voice he could listen to all day, a voice with a half a hundred different aspects, each of which he loved for different reasons. A contagious laugh, quick to rise and fall. The sharpness of her queen voice, as she issued orders that couldn't not be followed. The dry tone of her quick-witted quips and japes. The rough, textured voice that only he knew, whispered in the dark as they melted into each other's arms. Dozens of others sprang to mind too, but Terin swallowed them away. He was split in two. Terin dropped to his knees, tears pricking at his eyes. Inside, he felt empty, his innards scooped out, his bones cut away and tossed aside.
"I am a husk," he thought. "You are death,"
the monster purred. Terin didn't rise to the bait, didn't try to argue. He had no strength left to do so, no desire to fight. The belief that had driven him these last days was gone, vanquished by Anise's final words to him, words that would once have sent his spirits flying.
"I love you," he thought back. "Anise, Anise, are you there? I love you. Please don't leave me. Please come back to me. I will never leave you again. I promise.
The monster's laughter grated inside his head.
"She cannot hear you. Not any more."
Something twisted inside him. Pain. Agony. The knife that had stabbed him awake was now being turned measure by measure, destroying anything left of his soul. Anything and everything that made him human.
"I hate you," Terin thought. "Lies,"
the monster returned.
"If I kill myself, I will kill you too,"
he said aloud.
"You won't kill yourself."
Terin hated that the monster knew him better than he knew himself. Even as lost as he now felt, as alone, the monster was right. Terin would fight to the bitter end, even if the entirety of the world collapsed around him, which perhaps it already had. Dashing away tears with his hand, Terin stood. The enemy was coming. There was no time to waste. Only after the battle was decided would he grieve for the love he had lost. 37. The Hinterlands. Anise Gehrig. "Stop!" That single word was spoken, and the world froze. The spear's progress halted in midair, their wielders unblinking stares seeing nothing, though Anise could sense the hate in their eyes. They hated the girl who had spoken, the girl who now approached from their midst. They hated that she had the power to halt their violence. Though the girl's feet moved toward them, she seemed to float rather than walk, such was the grace of her movements. Her eyes were devoid of colour, pale, unseeing orbs, while her third eye, the glowing blue skin mark on her forehead, seemed to see right through them. Her skin was unnaturally smooth, like fine porcelain. Her dark hair hung in silken waves upon her shoulders. Anise felt a sense of comfort that was remarkable given the precipice upon which they stood.
"Who are you?"
Anise said, unable to hold back the question.
"I am she who brings," the girl said.
She waved a hand, and the warriors and their steeds began to shift back, away from them. Anise stepped forward, glad to be free of the cliff's edge once more.
"Why did you save us?"
Anise asked, watching in awe as those that had threatened their lives a moment earlier moved back and away, down the trail, as easily as one moved pieces on a game board.
"It was not your time to be taken," the girl said.
Though Anise was certain she was blind, the girl's white eyes seemed to pierce her directly. She wondered if her companions felt the same way.
"Thank you. You have come for the sleeping souls," the girl said. "How did you—" "I don't know. I am learning still, as we all are. My time here has been short."
By Anise's estimation, the girl was perhaps 18 name days old. Maybe 19. It was hard to tell because of how slight she was. Slender and graceful,
like a wisp of smoke, but still a woman grown, her small breasts hidden beneath the thick fur she wore. "You're beautiful," Dietrich said, and the girl's cheeks flushed pink. "Thanks for your contribution, sir," Anise thought, though she couldn't argue with the truth of his words. "The sleeping knights are dead," Anise said. "We saw their story. We saw how it ended."
"No, they live."
That single word, a spark of light in the darkness.
"How do you know?"
"I have seen them." Anise's breath caught.
"Where?"
"Hold on," Sejonius said. "What of the warriors? Those are the Ghazi, correct? They seem to want us dead. Thank you for protecting us, for saving us. But you must sleep sometime. You cannot defend us forever."
A thin smile formed on her lips.
"My name is Lisbeth Lorne," she said, "and I think I was meant to meet you."
"Me?" Dietrich said. "I was thinking the same thing."
"No,"
the girl said, which almost made Anise laugh, until she added,
"Her. I was meant to meet the Queen of the North."
They didn't exactly receive a royal welcome into the Ghazi village. More like stairs tipped with poisoned barbs and mouths filled with disgust. Several of the males, and even one of the females, spat in their general direction. Still, it was better than the reception they'd received from the pale, web-fingered cave dwellers. At least no one was trying to gnaw on them, at least not yet. Anise considered it a victory. A mob of Ghazi blocked their path, headed by the tall warrior who'd made their deaths such a priority atop the cliffs. This time, however, no weapons were drawn, the long spears sheathed on their backs.
"This wrong," the male said. "Pact broken. Blood must pay."
Though he spoke the common tongue, his accent was strong, each word short and clipped, like he was clearing his throat.
"Your traditions must be changed," Lisbeth said. "A new pact must be forged."
"Never."
"Step aside."
The small, thin girl continued to impress Anise with her mettle. There was something about her, something powerful, despite her small stature. She was a force of nature.
"I no fear you. Zer might. I do not."
"Zer doesn't fear me. But he does understand me better now. Soon you will too. Now step aside, or I will make you."
The great warrior stepped aside, as did the rest of them. Anise tried not to stare at them as they passed through.
"Do you ever get the feeling you're being watched?"
Arch whispered in her ear. Anise snorted, but didn't respond, her eyes taking in the dwellings formed of snow and ice. An ancient-looking woman watched them from outside one of them.
"Welcome to True North, Your Highness," she said with a nod.
"Thank you," Anise said, surprised by the genuineness in the woman's tone. "She is a friend," Lisbeth explained. "Perhaps my only one." "In saving us, you earned four more," Anise said.
The girl only nodded, turning her flawless face forward. They continued on, and Anise didn't need to look back to know the Ghazi warriors were following them. Their footsteps were the rumble of thunder. The constant threat of peril served only to heighten her senses. Though she should have been exhausted from their march through the tunnels and fight for their lives, she wasn't, the adrenaline continuing to course through her veins.
"I have seen them."
Lisbeth's words from earlier came back to her, sending a buzz of excitement through her chest. Unless there was some sort of miscommunication, the girl had just confirmed the sleeping knights not only existed, but were nearby.
"The North is not lost. Not yet."
They stopped before an enormous ice structure, at least 10 times larger than any others they'd seen so far.
"The Hall of War," Lisbeth said, beckoning them forward.
"What is inside?" Archer asked, taking a step forward.
"Truth. Destiny."
Though the words were cryptic, Anise felt the rightness in them, like everything about the girl standing before her was right.
"I don't know about the rest of you," Dietrich said, "but I don't mind a bit of truth and destiny. Shall we?
He started forward, but Lisbeth suddenly extended her hand and he collapsed to a knee, cradling his head in his hands. A deep groan rumbled from the back of his throat. Lisbeth's eyes widened, even as the eye marked on her forehead faded, and she retracted her hand. Dietrich toppled over, still holding his skull.
"I'm sorry,"
the girl said, bending over to touch him. He shuddered at her touch.
"I only meant to say you cannot enter this place. It is forbidden."
Dietrich turned his head, wincing. He used a hand to shield his eyes from the moonlight as if it was too bright for him.
"What did you do to me?"
"I saw..."
He trailed off, shaking his head.
I touched your soul. I'm sorry. I'm still learning."
Anise had no idea what to make of Lisbeth's words. Touched his soul. It obviously had something to do with her skin mark, her power. The way she had controlled the Ghazi earlier. Her power almost seemed godlike.
"Try throwing a snowball the next time instead," Anise said. "Are you hurt, sir?"
No, I don't think so."
He sat up, massaging his forehead.
"Then there is no harm."
Dietrich nodded, pushing back to his feet, his cheeks slightly pink, either from the cold or whatever the girl had done to him.
"Who can enter the Hall of War?"
Anise asked.
"You, the Queen of the North."
"Anise," Jonius warned, "we know nothing of this place, or what dangers it contains."
Anise turned to the man who'd, at times, felt like a father figure to her.
"Thank you for your concern, sir, but considering we have escaped death's grasp twice in one night, I'm willing to risk it."
Jonius nodded, duly chastened.
Archer said, "May I pass inside? I am still a prince of the North."
"I'm sorry," Lisbeth said. "This magic was forged centuries ago."
Archer bit his lip, appearing frustrated.
"Sorry,"
Anise mouthed.
"Fine."
She glanced at the Ghazi gathered around them.
"Will they be safe outside?"
The girl's easy, almost childlike smile was back.
"As safe as any of us," she said.
The Hall of War, though beautiful in its own way, was a forlorn place, the ice so thick it was almost black under the moonlight. The ceiling was high, vaulted to several points, a marvel of construction Anise couldn't fathom as being possible from the spear-wielding people outside. Her gaze travelled along the angles to the thick walls, passing to the centre of the large space, where icy columns rose from floor to ceiling. Not one or two, but dozens, perhaps hundreds. They were spaced an arm's length from each other, each identical, their glassy surfaces smooth and round. Something dark stared out from each of them. Anise's blood curdled.
"Do you see them, too?"
Lisbeth asked.
"Do you see the many colours?"
As they approached, Anise didn't see anything but darkness, armour as black as midnight, swords of obsidian steel, helmets like carved granite. And then... frozen, pale faces, staring out at her with unseeing eyes.
"Frozen hell,"
Anise whispered.
"A good description, perhaps,"
Lisbeth said, seeming to seriously consider her words.
"But sometimes hell forges the way for heaven, and the angels are only called upon when demons rise."
Like everything else, the girl said, her words sounded more profound in some than when taken individually. Anise shifted closer to one of the ice columns, her fingers trembling as she reached out to touch it.
"Careful,"
Lisbeth warned. Anise glanced at her, considered, and then touched the ice.
"Rise, O Queen! Rise, 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 rise!"
Anise fell back, stunned by the power, the sheer volume of the voice that burst inside her skull. If Lisbeth heard the voice too, she showed no evidence of it, standing as straight and stoic as before.
"They have waited centuries for this night," she said. "It's no surprise they should be slightly overeager. You can hear them. The moment we entered, they began their shouting. I hear them still. It makes it hard to have a conversation with you."
Once more, Anise was amazed by Lisbeth Lorne. Anise knew she wouldn't be able to think, much less speak, with that voice in her head. And Lisbeth was hearing hundreds of shouts, a cacophony of raw sound energy. She approached the column once more, but this time made no move to touch it. Staring into the ancient knight's eyes, she searched for any sign of him still being in there, still being alive.
"What do we do?"
she asked. Lisbeth turned toward her, and those blind eyes of hers once more seemed to pierce her flesh, her heart.
"First, you must understand." "Understand what?"
"This." The glowing blue eye began to form on the girl's forehead, slowly at first, but then brighter and brighter, until Anise was forced to squint or else be blinded. And then the Hall of War was gone, vanishing in an instant, replaced by a field of red flowers, blooming on every surface, glistening under the bright sun rising overhead. Hundreds, no, thousands, lay amongst them, bathing under the perfectly cloudless sky. Overcome by weariness, Anise wanted desperately to join them, to lie down, to rest amongst the scarlet bouquets, to sleep and sleep and sleep some more. And then she saw him, his sheer size unmistakable next to the other normal-sized people. Terin. He, too, slept, his hands folded across his chest, his expression one of complete tranquility. A smile burst upon her lips, and Anise ran through the flowers, mindless of how she trampled them underfoot. She weaved through the sleeping people until she was by his side, falling upon him, touching his face, his real, real face, with its protruding veins, which were no longer black but devoid of colour, snakes of pale flesh. She frowned, not understanding, shouting his name, kissing his lips with hers, pulling back sharply when she felt the iciness of his flesh, the unnatural cold. The world changed around her. The field turned to snow, the flowers to blood, the sleeping people to corpses, marred with dozens of wounds, their blank stares trained skyward at the thick blankets of grey clouds that replaced the clear blue expanse. And she couldn't breathe, couldn't breathe, couldn't
tear in,
she screamed. Her voice bounced from icy wall to icy ceiling and back again, and she found herself back inside the Hall of War, only Lisbeth Lorne and the sleeping knights there to hear her cry. She gasped, her eyes wide, trying to catch her breath.
"What was that? What did you show me?"
The girl didn't answer her question.
"Once you release these souls, you cannot recall them. Their violence will be complete. Their destruction total. Those who threaten the North will die." "Will he die?"
She couldn't say his name, not after feeling those cold lips, his unbeating heart beneath his chest, which refused to rise and fall.
"I am not a soothsayer nor fortune-teller," Lisbeth said. "Your soul speaks for itself, as does mine."
Anise felt like crying. Felt like throwing things. Felt like running away, fleeing north, never looking back. At least that way she would never have to face this decision. If she didn't release the sleeping knights, the north would fall. And if she did, Terin would. Love or kingdom. Happiness or responsibility. Passion or honour. Why did she have to choose? Why couldn't it be both? Why couldn't she be both?
"Because I am queen. Because I chose this. For my people. For my mother. For Archer."
The words were there, but they stuck in her throat.
"Oh, Terin. Oh, Terin. I'm sorry. So sorry."
She swallowed, licked her lips, spoke.
"Release them. Release them all. A queen has chosen,"
Lisbeth said. Her skin mark began to glow, blinding blue light radiating outwards as the eye formed. Voices rose as if in response, 100 speaking at once, unified in their message. "Time, time, defend the North, defend, fight, war, victory, victory!"
Anise looked away from the light, plugging her ears against the cacophony. The ground began to shake, and the blue ice pillars began to crack, sparkling crystals tinkling across the white floor of the Hall of War. Anise stared at the knights, each of whom stood atop their pedestals, unmoving, unblinking, their limbs frozen in place and time. In a strange way, Anise felt relief. It hadn't worked. They'd waited too long to find the knights, and they were beyond recovery, their slumber eternal. At the same time, she felt a sense of failure. Those two warring feelings did battle in her chest and mind. But then, one by one, the knights broke free of their pedestals, their movements jerky at first, but smoothing out as they shook off the haze of centuries of disuse. The knights were tall and strong, each clad in mail and adorned with fine weapons that seemed as equally preserved as they. Whatever magic had kept these men alive over the years was powerful indeed, perhaps as strong as Lisbeth's skin mark.
"We know our orders," they said, as one, though Anise had not spoken.
"We march for Darin at once," Anise said, waiting for some sign that they agreed.
Instead of a sign, the knights fell into line, marching from the Hall of War and out into the night. The Ghazi gathered outside, backed away, staring in awe at the scene before them. None moved to follow them, save for Anise and her travelling companions, each of whose jaws hung open.
"How?" Archer said.
"The girl,"
Anise answered. She noticed Lisbeth Lorne hanging back, conferring with one of the Ghazi, the old woman who had welcomed them to the village. The girl looked shaken, weakened, clutching the woman's shoulder. Lisbeth noticed her gaze.
"I will follow you," she said. "I promise. But I must attend to something first."
Anise nodded, gesturing for her companions to stride to the head of the night army. None looked back as they started south by another longer route, avoiding the cliffs and their deadly tunnels. 38. The Hinterlands. Lisbeth Lorne. Lisbeth's entire body was shaking like a leaf. Crone held her, rubbing her hands along her sides, trying to warm her. The woman didn't understand that it wasn't the cold. It was what she'd heard as she released the sleeping souls. What she'd seen. A single word, repeated over and over in succession, "Horde." The word in and of itself meant nothing to her, but when combined with the fragments of images that flashed through her mind, horrific scenes of war and bloodshed, entire nations thrown down by their enemies, their cities burned, their people annihilated, Lisbeth could hardly breathe.
"What is this new threat?"
she wondered. The images had been so fleeting, so full of destruction, but lacking detail. And then Xur was there, the warrior's soul very much alive and conscious, as he stood in the doorway.
"Girl saw my daughter," he said.
Rather than an accusation, he sounded defeated, exhausted. Lisbeth could not deny it.
"Yes."
His soul bobbed, nodding.
"Xur saw her, too. Saw what girl saw. Never knew she was strong at the end. Brave. Proud of her."
Lisbeth didn't know what to say. She'd thought she'd broken the man by touching his soul. Instead, it seemed, she'd enlightened him. Crone said,
"Girl, tell Xur what told me."
Lisbeth hesitated, but Xur encouraged her.
"Girl is no enemy. Xur knows that now."
Lisbeth pursed her lips.
"Thank you."
And then she told him what she'd seen and heard in the Hall of War. When she finished, Crone said,
"Xur knows what girl speaks of."
"Yes,"
Xur said, without hesitation.
"The fall of all things. It has been foretold for centuries. That is why we honor the Pact. That is why Ghazi must never leave these lands. Cold lands, safe."
Lisbeth's heart hammered in her chest.
"I have to go," she said.
She needed to catch up with the Queen and her knight army. needed to warn them of what was coming, even if she didn't fully understand it herself. She stood and moved toward the door, but Zer blocked her.
Ghazi do not fight below the lake. Girl knows that.
Yes, Lisbeth said.
Good.
He stepped aside.
Wish girl luck. Never return to these lands.
I won't, Lisbeth said. I promise. With that, she flew outside, following the churned-up path of marching warriors through the snow. None of the Ghazi tried to stop her. 39. The Northern Kingdom, on the road to Darin. Sir Christoph Metz. Since departing Castle Hill for Darin with only his battalion of female soldiers, in strict obedience of Zelda's command,
none of your men shall go to Darin's aid.
Sir Christoph Metz had learned something important. Women complained less and worked harder than men. It was because of this truth that they were ahead of schedule, a fact that helped comfort his orderly mind, even as he counted their continued steps toward Darin. Back in Castle Hill, he'd left several of his more experienced men in charge, to continue training and to await his return. By now, Queen Regent Zelda would have learned of his deception. Though he'd not broken the letter of her orders, he'd certainly shattered the spirit of them, and he wasn't so naive to believe there wouldn't be consequences. He could be stripped of his position as captain, or even have his knighthood revoked. However, to him, these risks were worth it. The people of Darin needed help, and he was in a position to give it. He'd appointed Private Sheary as his aide for the journey, and she'd been a great help thus far, organizing camp in accordance with his very specific orders. She'd even come to him late the night before, appearing at his tent with a simple question, "Do you need anything else from me?" For a moment he'd hesitated, tongue-tied, for something about the look in her eyes took his breath away. But then he'd said, "No, thank you, Private. That will be all." Why she'd looked disappointed at his response continued to confound him the next day, as they rode eastward through the snow. Inexplicably, she appeared beside him now, riding her brown-speckled white mare. "Private Sheary," he said formally.
"Captain Metz," she said, lowering her voice sternly, as if imitating him.
"Did I call for you?" He knew he hadn't, but there was no other reason for her sudden appearance. Strict riding formation was necessary in the event of an unexpected enemy attack.
"No," she said. "Nothing else. Just no."
He frowned, trying to decide what to say next without coming across as rude. Nothing sprang to mind, so he said nothing, the words of his mother guiding the decision. "When in doubt, say nothing." Private Sheary laughed, removing her helmet to run a hand through her silky dark hair, her jade eyes glittering in the sun. Christoph's frown deepened.
"Did I miss a jape? That happens to me a lot."
She shook her head.
"You miss more than just japes," she said.
He looked at her. Well, more like at her lips, which were pink and moist and almost more uncomfortable to look at than her eyes.
"Explain."
"Last night," she said.
"Last night?"
"When I came to your tent."
"You asked if I needed anything."
"Yes. And you turned me away."
"Yes, because I didn't need anything."
She laughed again.
"You're the queerest man I've ever met."
"I get that a lot," he muttered.
"And yet I continue to find myself drawn to you. Why is that?"
He stared at the path ahead, afraid to meet her eyes. No woman had ever spoken to him this way. Most just got angry with him and slapped him or threw water in his face.
"Perhaps it's my magnetic personality," he blurted out, having no idea where the words had come from.
Ah, yes. A jape he'd once heard another knight make. He still didn't understand it, not truly, but the collection of people gathered in the tavern had laughed loudly. And so, to his pleasure, did Private Sheary.
"You surprise me at every turn," she said. "May I visit your tent again tonight?"
"For what purpose?"
His cheeks felt hot, though the temperature was anything but. To talk.
About what?
We cannot determine the strategy for Darin until we reach the castle and assess the situation.
Not about strategy. Just about life. About you. About me.
Something about those last two sentences felt strange, like she had joined them together in her mind.
Women are a mystery I shall never understand,
Christoph thought, which almost made him laugh, considering he was now leading an entire platoon of them to battle.
I'm certain I don't understand what you mean, he said. I have little and less to say about myself.
Then I shall do the talking, she said. I will tell you stories to lighten your mood.
An example, please.
She looked away, seeming to consider his request for a moment. Then she spoke. Last night, while we slept on the cold, hard ground, I imagined it was something else.
What do you mean?
Besides women and jokes, imagination was yet another thing Christoph had yet to fully understand.
Your imagination was removed before you were born,
his mother always liked to say.
Well, before I joined the Queen's army, I was a maidservant for a lady in Blackstone. Not one of the major ones, but a rich one, nonetheless. She wasn't a particularly pleasant woman, but she paid me well, and I never wanted for food, clothing, or shelter. Anyway, she had this enormous bed. It was so big, I swear the entire city could have slept on it.
Christoph had the strong urge to inform her of the impossibility of her statement. No bed could be that large, but managed barely to hold his tongue. His mother would have been proud. She continued,
This bed was crafted of the finest goose down, an entire mountain of it that must have cost a small fortune to procure from the west, back before the trade was cut off. When she slept on it, I swear she looked dead. That's how peaceful she looked.
Metz didn't comment. He understood comparisons as well as anyone. Private Sheary looked at him expectantly, and he remembered that at this point in a story, most people had this strange habit. Rather than argue the point, he complied, feeling like a sheep being herded.
Then what happened?
She smiled, as if reacting to her own private little joke.
Well, my mistress went out for the day, as she did sometimes. She didn't require my services on this particular outing, so I was left to my own devices. What do you suppose I did?
Christoph was certain he didn't have the faintest idea. He shrugged.
Take a guess.
Christoph hated guessing games.
Took a nap.
She clapped her hands, dropping the reins.
Exactly! On my mistress's bed!
Christoph's eyes widened, surprised. In retrospect, he should have connected the two halves of the story, but establishing these kinds of relationships between facts were hard for him, especially when an action was such a clear breach of honour, duty, and etiquette.
She should have terminated your service, he said.
Private Sheary was fully laughing now.
She did, you dolt! When she found me sleeping atop her goose-down bed, nestled in the covers, hugging her pillow to my chest, she canned me on the spot. But it was worth it, Captain Metz. I've never slept so well in my life. If I didn't know better, I'd have thought I was sleeping on a cloud.
The knight could hold his tongue no longer.
But a cloud is a gaseous vapour, like smoke. If you slept on a cloud, you would likely fall to a violent death.
Thank you for that lovely image.
You're welcome. My point is, last night, as we slept on this awful, awful ground, I imagined I was sleeping on my old mistress's bed. And you know what?
He shook his head, as baffled as ever.
I awoke this morning as refreshed as the day I was terminated from my lady's service.
That's impossible, Christoph said automatically.
It's true.
You must have found a soft spot, a bed of soft snow or winter moss. Something.
No, she said. I checked. My resting place was as hard as everyone else's. My imagination fooled my body.
Christoph struggled to make sense of the senseless. the facts, if indeed they were facts, spread out before him, refusing to come into alignment. But how?
Sometimes belief is more powerful than truth, she said. Sometimes imagination rules logic and wisdom.
She flashed a final grin and, with that said, rode away, back into line. Christoph realized the distraction had made him lose count of his steps. More importantly, he didn't care. When, as she'd promised, Private Sheary came to his tent that night, he didn't turn her away when she asked,
"Captain, do you need anything?"
Instead, he said, "Yes, please. A story, if you will." She smiled as she entered, sitting cross-legged across from him.
"Of course. It shall be my pleasure."
40. The Western Kingdom, Night's End. Rhea Lorraine. As she stood on her balcony, gripping the railing, Rhea realized that the city of her childhood, the holy city, the city to end all cities, Night's End, had become her own personal prison. She hated its endless walls, its cobblestoned streets, its purity dresses and temples, and righteous warriors garbed in red. For here, in this place, in this castle, lived only ghosts, each and every one seeming to haunt her every waking step and the hollows of her dreamless sleep. Everyone she had ever loved, her father, her mother, Grey Aris, Ennis Lorraine, and, yes, even Bea. She'd loved her once, a long time ago. The memories of her youngest sister were like pins in her skull.
When did I grow to hate her? Why did we push each other away at every turn?
Even her unborn child felt like a ghost inside her, a lost soul. In some ways, the losses humbled her, made her want to change, to finally listen to Ennis's advice and seek peace with their eastern and southern neighbors.
"I can heal you,"
Roan's words before he left, words that she now clung to like the only thread keeping her from tumbling off a precipice and into the void. Though she'd been no saint before the Furia had marred her beauty, her worst sins had come after. It was no excuse, but perhaps it was an opportunity to start over. If Roan healed her, maybe she could use it as an excuse to rescind her previous proclamations. The child growing in her belly stirred.
"Roth, what would you have me do?"
It was the first time in years she'd directly addressed the God of the West.
"Are you there?"
Nothing answered her but silence and the rush of a cool wind through her hair.
"I am empty. I am lost. I am broken. Ennis, oh, Ennis, come back to me. Come back."
But he wouldn't. He couldn't. She'd cast him away with her words, her truth. Could she change? Would it make a difference? No. The course she'd set herself on was a leap from a cliff into a dark sea, and nothing could arrest her fall now. She would leave this city, ride with Darkspell east. She would see this done personally. The Orions would die and the east would fall. After that, the four kingdoms would be hers for the taking. This vision, this goal, was the only thing she had left. It was a week later, and for the first time in her life, Rhea looked upon the east. Though it was still far off in the distance, obscured by the clouds of smoke that cast a haze over everything, the tangle continued to burn out of control. She could see the green countryside, emerald grass and tall trees and farmsteads dotting the plains. Only the great silver line of the spear separated the kingdoms.
"Such a small barrier," she thought.
Thus far, Rhea Darkspell and her retinue of Furia had travelled primarily along the western road, but in the last day had shifted southeast. The purpose was to avoid Hyro Lake and the recently rebuilt Bridge of Triumph. This wouldn't be a mission of force, but of stealth. Now, as they approached the end of their journey, Rhea had to swallow away the second thoughts that continued to plague her.
"Why do I care what happens to the Orions?"
she wondered. For years they'd killed her people without compassion, using their Rothdam ore magic against the West. She knew the reason. Ennis. She could almost feel him looking at her in that judging, serious way of his. Yes, he was far too old for her. He'd been more of an uncle figure than a cousin growing up. And yet, something about how he treated her made Rhea feel good, wanted. Like she was beautiful, despite her scars.